It has been tasked to us to talk about how to resolve conflict and how to maintain peace in the home. So we've been arguing about that all week. And I have to say that I think a recent survey said that people have a greater fear of dying than public speaking. So Maria would literally be rather dead than doing what she's doing right now. She's terrified of public speaking, but she always does a great job. So we're going to talk about conflict resolution. Now, a couple of things to note. First of all, this isn't just for married people. This is for single people. This is for really any relationship you have in your life, whether as, you know, an employer, an employee, a teacher, your siblings, any relationship you have in your life, these principles and these concepts will work for you. And there's a lot that could be said about conflict resolution. In fact, it goes well beyond the scope of what, you know, a 30-minute speech or something could be. Conflict resolution can be a complicated issue. So there's great resource out there on how do we learn to ask open-ended questions. How do we learn to not using escalating language? Escalating language is like, every time this happens, you do this. That's designed to escalate. It's designed to shut down conversations. Learning to be grounded so that you can have, you know, an appropriate environment to speak productively. Like what we say all the time is everybody fights. We have to learn how to fight successfully. That's sort of the whole point. So if you've never gone through any kind of lesson like that, or if the church offers something like that, be sure you take advantage of it because it's extraordinarily helpful. Peter Scazzaro has a book called Emotionally Healthy Spirituality that I would highly recommend. You maybe have gone through it, but it does help us learn how to sort of express those things that sometimes lie beneath the surface. Now, let's be honest with ourselves. I'm tempted to just go around the room, but I don't think we need to. It probably doesn't take us very long for us to think about the things that we fight about, is there? I mean, there's all kinds of things. If you're married people, you parked your car in my spot, you left dishes in the sink, you threw your dirty underwear on the floor, you didn't wash the towels when I asked you. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on, right? And it could be, there's probably not even a point to discuss the what we fight about, because we fight about all kinds of things. What we want to do is talk about the why we fight, because that's actually more important. The what is just a thing. It's just something that came up and we fight about it. But the why that we fight about is the part that we don't spend enough time talking about and really lies at the heart of every challenge that we really have in all of our relationships. So we're going to try to deal with the why we fight, and we're just going to kind of give it a surface look, but you are going to leave here today with some very tangible steps that you can begin to implement right now, right today. Some of it for us has even begun through our worship time today. So these are things that you are going to leave here today with a feeling of hope and a sense that if you're having some struggles in some of the relationships in your life and conflict seems to be something that sort of follows you, you're going to leave here today with some hope. And aren't sanctuaries supposed to be places of hope and peace? And a lot of that's already happening today. So let's pray for that, and then let's talk a little bit about how we can learn to resolve conflict. God, thank you for this congregation, and what a joy to be able to worship with them and to hear the voices of your people singing with boldness and just seeing all that you're doing here. I love this congregation, and I know that there are so many wonderful plans that you have for Lee and for Wendy and for the good people of Mercy Vineyard, and we're excited to partner with them on that as well. We pray for our folks at Cross Point Church today and feel that and pray that they would feel a sense of your presence and power and hope and peace as well in their worship this morning. And so bless us today. We pray it in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right, so first of all, let's talk a little bit about us, because we all bring something into every relationship, don't we? That relationships don't start in a void. We bring us, our family, our culture of origin into those relationships. So I'm a pastor's kid. I was raised in Northern California, rural Northern California. A lot of times people think of California, you think of San Diego, and they, you know, think of beaches or Central California, the Bay Area, San Francisco. But this is rural Northern California, so it's agriculture, it's mountains, it's crops, it's cows. That's where we grew up. And I grew up in a pretty small, and I would probably articulate it as a very conservative, both theologically and sociologically, church and sociological environment. I had a big family. I'm the middle of six boys, and I'm a twin, so that's going to explain most of it. I can just say, you know, I need to read Scazzaro's book again, I guess. So that's going to frame up a lot of who I am. Everything in my life was small except for my family. So a small church, a small school, a small community. But my family was big, and it was, if I used a describing word, it was just chaotic. With six boys, it's just going to be some chaos that goes with it. And there were a couple of things, and what we're both going to talk about when we talk about our family of origin, there were a couple of things that deeply framed me as a young man, and things that I carried into my adulthood, false imagery. One of them was how we sort of saw emotion. So both of my parents grew up in really dysfunctional homes. And when they married, they were Christians. My dad was in ministry, and they were really determined to do better than the dysfunction of their family, and they did. My dad passed away a couple of years ago. He's my hero, wonderful man. But just like all of us, had some blind spots. So some of it was, as I reflect, I think some of the pain of their family of origin, kind of a way to escape sometimes pain, is to sort of say, well, our emotions can't be trusted. Emotions are weak. Emotions are feminine. So for a young boy, it was sort of a feminine way to think. You couldn't trust emotions. They were bad. Has anybody ever said, you've probably heard somebody say, or maybe said it to your child, hey, man, you need to control your emotions. You've all probably said that. But how many of us have said to our child, you need to control your intellect? My intellect gets me in way more problem than my emotions. So when you begin, I mean, we're made in God's image. So every emotion that I feel is, God has felt infinitely. So my emotions aren't bad. In fact, my emotions are very good. I need to learn to trust them. In many respects, the Bible talks about, in the Jewish concept of emotion was your guts, your reins. It's that inward parts is how David describes it. So in our own Western culture, you might say, trust your guts, you know, that kind of thing, where your intellect, what we call our brain, was the heart. So in Jewish theology, there would be both of these things that you trusted equally. So part of it is, a big part of my formation was, my emotions are bad, they're wrong, they're weak, they're feminine, they can't be trusted. Now imagine what that does to a very emotional young guy and six other very emotional young guys. It creates a false sense of self. The other thing that happened in my life is what I would best sort of describe as a false sense of manhood, of manliness. Men were people that didn't ask for help. They didn't. They just got it done. You worked hard. You raised your family. You were a faithful husband. You took your family to church. Now those are all good things, but what it kind of created in me was a false sense of masculinity. Men didn't ask for help. You got it done. It was sort of that. It's what some sociologists call the myth of the self-made man. There's no such thing. So some of you young guys, if you've ever sort of been kind of pulled into that, there's no such thing. There's no such thing as a self-made man. We all grow. We all work. We all live in community. And so nobody's pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. Nobody's just, you're not going to work another few hours every day. You're not going to add another day to your week. You're not going to be a little smarter, a little stronger, a little faster, get another job. It just doesn't work that way. So there's no such thing as a false, of a self-made man. Okay, manliness is actually, the scope of manliness, in my opinion, is being able to ask others for help and learning to express need. So those are two big parts of my spiritual formation that were false concepts, that I couldn't trust my emotions, emotions were bad, and that strong men didn't need to ask for help. They just got it done. Maria, tell us a little bit about your family of origin.
Also grew up in a really small area. We actually lived a field, two fields away. So I could look outside and there was a road that you couldn't see, but I mean, it was literally two fields away. And we would drive by the school that his parents had started, and I thought it was, no offense, we've said this a lot, was abandoned. I didn't know that there was a school there. So he grew up in the same town. I grew up in a public school. He grew up in a Christian school. And it was crazy that we met when we were 20 and never knew each other. And this town was only about 5,000 to 7,000 people in this town. So I'm first generation Mexican-American. My first language that I spoke was Spanish. We were a middle class family, which was rare back growing up. Most of my family, my aunts and uncles and cousins grew up in
Central California.
Yeah, in Southern California, but they worked in the fields. So we were middle class. So that was something that was new for us, for our first generation.
Most of her family were migrant workers.
Yes, thank you.
And her father kind of broke that kind of traditional role.
So we grew up Catholic. We never missed church unless we were on vacation. It was a wonderful way that we grew up. I mean, faith was such an important part of our lives. Everything we did in the church was what we did in our family. I mean, no matter what was happening, we were always at church, and I'm very grateful for that upbringing. My mom was a very traditional homemaker. When we got home from school, there was always food, and that's the way she expressed her love to all of us. It was absolutely wonderful. I remember starting school when I was, obviously in kindergarten, and one of the things that I remember is not being able to speak the language. So I knew a couple words, and that made it just scary for me, right? And then as I grew, one of the things that was really difficult is I struggled in school. I struggled in school all of my life. And one of the things that I remember mostly about growing up in school was just how I wasn't very smart. And even teachers would say, you're not very smart. And kids would, yeah. So that really was a difficult part of my childhood, just growing up and thinking that I was stupid. And every time that I would study or I'd really try to apply myself, I would still get a D or I'd still get a very bad grade, and I'd go, okay, yeah, definitely school is not my thing. People was more my thing. So that was always a really hard thing growing up, and it affected the way I would think about myself. So that's a little bit.
So you can imagine bringing, you grew up speaking Spanish, and now you're going into a school where there's no Spanish-speaking people, and the kids make fun of your language, and then you struggle in school with learning, learning processes and things like that. So you bring into a relationship and a marriage sort of a sense that your opinions don't matter, that you're maybe just not as smart as the next person, and sort of that feeling and that diminishment. One of the things that's been great about Maria's journey, another book that if you haven't read it, maybe check out, it's a book called Mindset. And what this sort of thinking in Maria, it created in her a sense that she just couldn't move forward in academics. But what she's learned is, no, I just learned differently than other people. So, I just learned differently. I experienced differently. So it doesn't mean I'm stupid. It doesn't mean I'm dumb. It doesn't mean that I can't contribute. It just means my concepts, my processes are maybe a little bit different than other people.
I discovered this book. I'll tell this quick story because it tells us how we work together. We were getting ready to do our first trip to Nicaragua, a missions trip that we were doing, and one of our friends suggested this book for our youth because mindset, it's either a growth mindset or a fixed mindset is what you learn from this book. And I knew I had some time on the plane to read it, but I knew I wouldn't finish it. I knew we were going to have some time, so I thought by the time we get back, it's a 10-day trip, I'll have this book done. And it's only like this. So I get on the plane, and I open up the book, and I read. I'm just at the first few pages of it. Everything that I had thought about myself growing up was answered right then, that I was not dumb, that I was not stupid. It was absolutely, it was incredible. And growing up with someone like, our marriage, 30 years, being with Jim, he always would tell me, you can do anything, you can accomplish anything. It was crazy how he'd always tell me those things. And it took me a lot of years to believe it, but I was believing it, you know, and I was like, you know what, I'm not book smart, but I'm really good at these other areas. Reading this book, just the first chapter, I was going, oh my gosh, I closed the book and I go, you have to read this book. Because I knew, I knew that he would have it read by the time we landed. So sure enough, I handed him the book. By the time we landed in Nicaragua, he had already finished it. And he was like, oh my gosh, Maria, this. And I was like, right, we have to totally teach this. And so that was the introduction to this book. And just, that's the book that has made the biggest difference in my life besides the Bible. I'm not kidding. It has changed the way, that's why I'm even sitting here today. It just changed my mindset completely.
Yeah. So if you've ever felt stuck and felt a fear of kind of moving your life forward, it really is a great academic resource that's framed up in thousands of academic studies. So that's a little bit about us. So she brought into it this false sense that she's dumb, she's diminished as a person. I brought into our relationship a false sense of who I am in terms of my emotional concepts, what it means to be a man. Now, we didn't get, before we talk about the things that we did wrong, let's talk about a few of the things that we did right. The first thing we did right in our marriage, and so maybe some of you that might be thinking of marriage or something of that nature, the first thing we did right was we liked each other. Please don't marry somebody you don't like. There's just, we super liked each other. We just liked to hang out. We'd sit around in cars and talk, and we'd have fun, and we got to kind of know each other through our community, and Maria had a best friend that kept trying to set us up. She says, there's this really cute redhead, and he's really funny, and Maria goes, I don't think I've ever met a really cute redhead. So that's rude.
That's exactly what I said.
I know.
There's
super
no such
rude
thing as a cute redhead.
And I'm very sensitive. So
he is.
So we had this. We just liked each other. We liked to go bowling. We liked to shoot pool. We liked to just sit around, have a beer together. We just liked doing life together. And the other thing that we got right was faith. So tell us a little bit about faith. Yeah.
So here's this long-haired rock and roller, you know. We worked together.
Played in a band.
That
your mother will love that if you're dating someone that played in a band.
And, you know, he was definitely, like I said, he is not my type. I mean, I just, you know, redheads. I'd never even thought about dating a redhead.
Again,
rude.
Deep emotions.
Deep emotional scars. And he's really sensitive. And so my best friend and still a dear friend kept saying, you know, you guys should date. But we all hung out together. We all were, you know, laughing a lot. And one night Wendy said, I think you should ask Maria out. And Jim says, I'm not really dating. We're just on a break right now from the band. And, you know, we travel. We're gone all the time. Dating is not a good thing. And the next day, he shows up at my job and asks me out.
And that's not technically true because I worked there because I'm a rock star. I was also had this side gig at Kentucky Fried Chicken, frying the chicken, because I wanted to make sure it was done with the rock star's touch.
Yeah.
But I actually worked there, and all I ever heard about was this sort of. This pretty Mexican girl that worked up in the front, but she was never there. She worked like twice a month. So then I heard about this mysterious woman, but never actually met her. So then one day I hear this knock on the back of the door. So it's actually, I didn't show up at her work. I'm actually working here. And then she's like, who are you? I go, well, I work here. She goes, well, so do I. And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, hey, Wendy, there's a mouthy Mexican out here that would like to see you. So that was actually our introduction.
So. Yeah, exactly like that. So Wendy was so funny. She's like, no, I really think, you know, you guys get along really well. She's telling Jim, and Jim's like, I don't know. So we did. So we went on our first date, and it was hilarious. But the thing that, it was probably four or five weeks into dating, he said, hey, can I talk to you about something? And I was like, he goes, it's really serious. And I'm going, oh, okay, yeah. So went out, and he says, you know, my faith is really important to me. And I was like, well, my faith is really important to me, you know. And he goes, no, I mean, it's really important to me. And I go, okay. He goes, you know, I really like you. He says, and I can just see us, you know, going further into this relationship. He says, and I said, well, I'm Catholic. And he says, okay. He says, I'm not. I'm like, okay. And I said, okay. And I go, well, okay. And he goes, I go to church every week. And I go, I do too, you know. So he says, I just want us to be able to, he goes, I'd like you to visit my church. And I was like, sure, I'll visit your church. You know, growing up, that was, my dad always said, you know, faith is so important. And it was expressed in our family life, everything that we did, every celebration, everything, it was always with the church, you know. So that was really important to me. And so then we started going to church together right away, which was very, most people would not believe that if you'd have met him back
then. Yeah,
in the day.
And, you know, I mean, I didn't really think it would be too big a problem because, you know, Protestants and Christians have been getting along for centuries, right? I don't know if you guys are church history people, but the answer is no, not at all. All right, so, but we figured it out. We figured out faith, and we liked each other. So those are two things that we got right. So those are some things that were very, very helpful to us because we did have a grounding. No matter how much we might disagree about something, and there hasn't been big things, but when there was, in the end, we still liked each other, and we still worshiped together, and those were foundational things for us. But we had things that we had to figure out. Am I telling the one about the cooking or the one about the...
I don't know. Am I telling about my mom right now?
Oh, yeah, you can tell that one.
So it was, and it wasn't easy in the decision that we were going to end up making was that I was going to leave the Catholic Church. That was a very difficult, decision for my family. We had to, we had to switch the church that we were actually having our ceremony in. And so, through the years, it was very painful for them, but it's really interesting to see how God has, healed all that. And now, we are, you know, I mean, it's just not a thing. My mom is just so excited to see where our family is and what we're doing and how our kids were raised and, you know, and just the impact that our faith has had in our lives. And so, anyways, it was not easy,
but and our kids are still illegitimate. So.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, they are. If you know anything about the Catholic Church.
I'm making jokes.
Yeah. It's all right. That's what he does.
Okay, so we had some of those things, right? But we still had a lot of things in our relationship that we needed to sort of understand. So I'm doing the food one, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so
yes.
Maria grew up, as she's already mentioned, at, you know, in Hispanic, as in many types of homes, food is a very deep expression of love, of care. And so she said, she always said her mother would say, what, you know, she would make eggs for one child and you know,
it was
pancakes
a buffet in
for
the morning.
Another, and you could have this. And my mom said, here's a big bowl of oatmeal. So it wasn't an expression of love. And that was part of kind of our some of the differences in it. Is just, my mom's a wonderful lady. She's just an outstanding woman. But she's not a nurturer, and she'll tell you that. I had six kids. Somebody had to feed them. I guess that's my job. And so big bowls of oatmeal it was, you know. So
and she worked full-time.
She worked full-time. And so... So that's not an expression that I grew up with. Food was just something you eat, calorie in, calorie out, and you kind of move about your day. So then we get married and we begin to have children. And one of the constant frustrations for me is that Maria is a very hard worker, and she would come home and she would prepare these wonderful meals, all prepared, ready to eat. But I couldn't see the meal. All I could see was, good Lord, you used every pan in the kitchen. It's a pile this high. Who's going to clean all this? Well, I cooked. You should clean. I'm like, I don't want to clean this. I want to, for me, a peanut butter sandwich is fine. Now, it sounds like a weird thing, but it really was. It really was a challenge for us because I didn't have that. I didn't realize this was a deep part of her cultural expression. In my family, it was chores. So chores was the expression of love. Get the chores done. So for me, I'm like, oh, it's going to be hard for me to sit down and enjoy this meal when there's a mountain of dirty dishes in the sink. And so then I'd start, and it just led to frustration. And then she felt devalued, right? If you've cooked a good meal and everybody's like...
An amazing meal. Homemade. Yeah. I mean...
Very good.
Okay. I know. Can't even tell you how delicious.
I know.
How
I
delicious
know.
It was.
Y'all are sitting there going, wow, you really married a jerk. But so I had to learn something. I had to learn about sort of her cultural expressions of love. But then she also had to learn some of my cultural expressions of love, didn't we? So we actually developed a weird thing that I know it's going to sound, it probably won't work for your family, but weirdly it does for us, is if we say, if you have the energy to cook, you have the energy to clean. That's it. There's no I cook, you clean. Now, you can do that first. You can say, hey, I'll tell you what, it's kind of a long day. I'm tired. I'll cook if you'll clean. And then that gives me the opportunity to say, nah, let's just go hit, you know, Barrel House. So I know it's weird for our family, but we had to learn some things that we carried in value because of our family of origin. Okay, and we did. So I learned to appreciate her cooking, which is phenomenal. She learned to appreciate my fastidiousness, which is probably not so phenomenal. And then I got to tell you this: in this last year, I've been learning to cook more and more. So I have grown to greatly appreciate all the work that she's done. It's a ton of work. But those are cultural things that... So the issue wasn't really in the what, okay? Remember we talked about the what and the why. The what wasn't so much that there were dirty pans in the sink or that there was a meal that wasn't appreciated. The why, the real problem was she's feeling diminished because I'm not appreciating her cultural expression of love, and I'm feeling diminished because she's not understanding or respecting my cultural need from my family of orientation about cleaning and the tasking. So you see what the problem was? In the end, it's not really about dishes. It's not really about food. It's about the why. And we fought a lot about that until we finally began to go, oh, okay, there's something more here. And then speaking of it, tell us how we used to fight.
So Jim, as you can see, is very expressive with his words. His vocabulary is, I can't even tell you. Words he says, I just go, to this day, I'm like, mm-mm. Can you tell me what that means? I mean, really, his family, his dad also had a doctorate, and Jim has a doctorate. I mean, the vocabulary is crazy. So when we were younger, he would just... I need to talk to you about this, and this is what I'm thinking, and this is, and he would just, you know, just, and these words that would come out, and I'd just be like, so then I would feel...
Don't say the word, by the way. Okay, just want to make sure.
So the only way I felt that I could defend myself or argue with him was to call him a bad name. That's what I would do. I would just be like, and you are, and then...
And it was a really bad name. It was really... This isn't like you're a jerk. This is a really bad name.
But I can't even tell you. I mean, he would just talk and talk and talk and argue and argue and argue, it would make sense. I would tell him, I go, I know that by the end of this conversation, it's going to make sense. And I don't have any words because I just cannot talk like you talk. So then I would just defend myself with the words I did know. So.
Now, the real issue, now one day we're kind of talking, I go, why do you always call me that? I've never called you those words.
And he's very sensitive.
Sensitive. I'm a sensitive guy. So finally she says, it's because I just feel like you're not hearing me. I feel like I can't express myself the way that you can express yourself. And it diminishes me. Now, I didn't mean to do
makes
that.
Makes me feel stupid.
I really
stupid.
Didn't mean to do that. Since then, what I've learned is that sometimes I can be a little overbearing. And now, what's happened, when we go to dinner with people and I kind of start getting in my little thing, she'll reach over and, like, tap me on the leg or something, or she'll kick me under the table, and that's code to say, you know, rein it in a little bit, buddy. Because I don't always know. I don't always know. But you can imagine, then, somebody who had sort of diminishment issues coming in before a marriage, feeling like she wasn't being heard, that she wasn't smart, that she didn't have an intellectual contribution to make, then to be married to somebody who wasn't a very good active listener, that hadn't learned how to ask open-ended questions. It wasn't anything that I intended to do, but it was pressing. The why became really painful for her. Because when we would fight, we wouldn't fight successfully because she would feel diminished as a person. Okay, so we had to learn that. It made a lot of sense to me. I go, you know what? That makes a ton of sense. So I learned how to express myself better. She stopped calling me bad names.
I did too. Yes.
And then she grew. She learned to be more bold in her assertions. So instead of just sort of responding, she learned to actually assert herself and have a sense of confidence and recognition that her ideas are good ideas and they need to be expressed, which I always had as a value, but didn't always, you know, communicate that.
Right. And growing up in a Mexican home, Mexican-American home, Hispanic home, you know, the wife's duties were definitely to anything that the husband said. I'm very grateful my dad was not a typical Mexican man, machoism, that kind of stuff. You know, my mom had a ton of freedom, like we would normally have freedom, but she never was very, we never saw them fight, we never saw them argue, there was always just a sense of whatever my dad said, that's what we did. So that came into our relationship. So it was hard for me to express my needs to him. It was very difficult.
Not only as someone who has felt diminished in her ideas and her concepts and her intellect, but also growing up in a patriarchal concept, mm-hmm. of sort of a false sense of personhood, of what a woman is, of what a man is, etc. Now there's still, so those are things that we can sort of learn, but we learned about some of that stuff. There's something else we had to learn, which I think, as I reflect on it, was one of the most important aspects of it. As you may know, I traveled in a rock band for about 10 years. So we traveled all over the country, and that was sort of how we made our living. But the big hair era. So this is 1984 to 94. So, whoa, living on a prayer. Right. You're like, what? Okay, so after the band had broke up, and these were my brothers, they literally were my brothers and best friend, and when the band broke up, it was sort of kind of an ugly thing, and everybody just went to the four winds of the world. Now, what it left in me was sort of so I'm 28, I have to reinvent my whole career, my whole life. And I don't know how to do that, and I'm lonely because the guys that I did all of my life with are now no longer a part of my life. I have a false sense of manhood and a false sense of emotion and expression. So every birthday, I just grew to hate. They would fill me with a sort of a sense of despair, of loneliness, of getting another, and I was only, 28, 29, 30 at that time, and I just hated them. I hated them. And Maria would always sort of say, what do you want to do for your birthday? And because I don't express need, and I have a false sense of manhood and an emotive sense, I go, oh, whatever you want to do is fine. The problem is, not everything was fine. I did have things I wanted. I did have needs, and it was not fair because I was leaving that expectation to be discovered by my family and by my kids, and it would put them in this impossible situation because an unarticulated need is hardly ever met. And so I wasn't expressing needs, and then I'd get all bent because they weren't getting, or hurt because they weren't getting met. So tell us what that would do to you and the kids. And
I remember one particular birthday, and we were actually we were at my sister's, and my sister said, "Hey, it's Jim's birthday. You know, when you guys are going to be here on vacation?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "What do you want to do?" And I was like, "I don't know. I don't know what to do. I'll ask him, but he's not really going to tell me what he wants." And so I remember waking up on his birthday that morning and crying. Because I was so stressed, because I knew that by the end of the day, it was going to be a bad day. It was not going to be what he wanted. Every year I would try so hard, the kids and I, to figure out what he wanted to do. And it was just never the right thing.
Because that's not fair, is it? It's not fair to sort of insist that people guess your needs. But then when they don't guess them right, you feel diminished. You feel unsatisfied. Okay? Now, and it's because I had a false sense of manhood. Men don't express, my dad never said, "Oh, here's what I'd like to have for my birthday." I have no idea what he would want, but those were never conversations we had. Nobody ever asked you, "Hey, what do you want for dinner?" Or, "Hey, what do you want for this?" Or, "Hey, what do you want for that?" Or, "How do you want to celebrate this?" It just sort of... You didn't express need. So I thought I was just sort of doing what was right, and in the end, it ended up causing a lot of pain for the people I love. Now, those are just three simple stories, and we're going to kind of keep moving here, but those are three stories that hopefully help you understand that it's not really the stuff. It's not really the what, is it? It's the why, okay? That's really why we fight. It's the why. So how do we get out of the what and into the why, and then what do we do with it? Now, this conversation, it goes beyond the scope of this conversation to talk about mental health. So mental health is a huge part of this. We're living in that world right now. So a lot of your reactions, a lot of that we think are unhealthy may be driven by some mental health issues. It can be driven by substance abuse, obviously, is some of the characteristics. Usually those two are kind of connected together, and those two things are usually a part of culture and family of origin and things that you sort of carried into your adult life. So there's a lot of other things. Really knowing who you are, if you've experienced sexual abuse, which is real common, if you've been physically abused, emotionally abused, you carry all these things into your relationships, and that can all impact it. So again, we're just sort of scratching the surface, but really quickly, let me just sort of tell you a little something about where we are right now. I think it was about, 6 or 8 months ago. It was a long time ago that Lee said, "Hey, would you guys be willing to do this?" And we have such a wonderful relationship with y'all. We thought that would be super fun. And it has been super fun. So thank you. But if we had known that we would be in the season that we're in right now, I would have said, "No way. No way. It's too much going on." We're kind of in the middle of what's been a really, really long and the most difficult season of our lives with mental health and with addiction and with some of the real challenges of our family. And I can't talk a lot about it, obviously, because these are very kind of sensitive issues. But this is now 2 and 3 years of this for us, where you kind of go, if you've ever kind of been in that world of mental health, you go from one disaster to another disaster to another disaster to another disaster. So after a while, there's no more money, there's no more words, there's no more emotional capacity. Everything is exhausted. So at the end of that, at the season that we're in right now, we are emotionally completely exhausted, completely tapped out. It's impacted every single aspect of our life, our church, our businesses, our relationships, our marriage, our extended family and friends. There is not one area of our life that is not frayed to the point of snapping. And I mean that sincerely. I almost called Lee and said, "I can't. I got nothing, man. I'm just going to read from, the five love languages or something, because I have no words." But God did give us some words. And here's what's cool about it. We're not looking back. So we've told you some stories, but we're not looking back to something that has happened to us, a dark season that we got through and figured it out. We're in the middle of it. So these are real time snapshots of our life right now. And what I am grateful for is that we had really good people in our life. We've worked really hard at this. We have all the tools. We're very optimistic. We're very hopeful. We're going to move forward. We're going to be fine. But we are, this is not something that we're going, yeah, we did this years ago and it really helped our marriage. This is like what we're going through right now. We're having to form intentional boundaries. We're having to apply the rules of things we've learned. And I know it will help us and it will help you as well. So these are very simple. If you're a note taker, you might want to take them down. But and they're really simple. But let's, can we get that first one up on the board? Here's your first principle. No, the bullet point. Do I have that bullet point? You matter. Okay? You matter. If you don't feel like you matter, let me tell you, you do. That was settled on the cross. When Jesus said, "It is finished," he forever stamped his approval on you. Forever. And no one can ever take that off. The Bible always starts with personhood before it goes to behavior. Okay, so we tend to sort of reflect a lot on behavior, but the Bible always goes to personhood first. So you matter. Maria, can you read that verse for us? I don't have my glasses on.
But God showed his great love for us by sending Christ to die for us while we were still sinners. Romans 5:8.
Okay, can't say it any more simply than that. You matter to God. You are extraordinarily important to God. Now, if you matter to God, okay, now get this. If you matter to God, your needs matter to God. Okay, and not just, the Bible does talk about, you know, Jesus on his famous Sermon on the Mount, he says, hey, I've taken care of the birds, I'm taking care of the fields, I'm taking care of all this stuff. Your heavenly Father knows you need those things too. And he's taken care of those things. We know that we can trust him, but it's every single one of your needs. It's your emotional needs. It's your spiritual needs. It's every part of your aspect. Let's read this one together. Maybe we can all read this together. And this same God who takes care of me will supply all your needs from his glorious riches, which have been given to us in Christ Jesus. That's all of your needs. Okay? That's all of them. So you matter. Your needs matter. Can we go to number three? Unarticulated needs are seldom met. Now, every now and again, there are people placed here on planet Earth that I think might be angels, and they'll just walk up at the right time with the right word, the right thing, and it's miraculous, and it's wonderful, and it's also very uncommon and rare. Generally speaking, we need to learn to articulate our needs to the people that need to know them. Otherwise, we're leaving them to guess our needs, and that's not fair to them, right? So we need to learn to express them. Now, in learning to articulate need, you may need to learn some things about yourself. You may need to go talk to a counselor. You might need to talk to a medical doctor to understand mental health. There's probably things you need to learn about yourself so that you know what your needs are. Some of the things that I had to learn about myself, I didn't even know they were needs. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Again, that's why Scazzaro and others can be such a big help. But unarticulated needs are hardly ever met if you don't express them, and it's not fair to the people that you love. In Romans, the Bible talks about how God knows our prayers before we even pray them. The Holy Spirit is intervening on our behalf. But your loved ones aren't God. Okay, we're not God. I can't guess your needs. I don't know what they are unless you tell them. So we need to learn to speak our needs. Let's read this together. Stop telling lies. That's a different translation than I was looking at. The NIV says put off all falsehood. All falsehood. So when I have a false sense of myself, when I have all these falsehoods built up, and then I'm communicating people through these falsehoods, how much of it am I getting right? None of it. You got to take the falsehoods off. You got to get rid of them. Then let us tell our neighbors the truth, for we're all part of the same body. You can't really know me until I put off my false sense of self, the veneer of righteousness, all of the little fake false things we put up, can we? So get rid of that stuff. It's not helping anybody. Let's go to the last one. care for the needs of others. So once you recognize that you matter to God and you should matter to the people around you. If you don't matter to the people around you, get rid of those people, okay? You matter to God and you should matter to the people around you. Second, your needs matter. Because you matter, because God cares for you, your needs matter. When you learn to express them in an honest and right way, then the people around you should be able to listen and hear and act in love. Here's what Galatians says. Paul says to the church in Galatia. Share each other's burdens, and in this way obey the law of Christ. Okay, now these are things, folks, we can start doing this today. Okay, if you're having any struggles in your marriage, your relationships, anything that you want to see begin to improve with the people that you're living life with, you can begin these concepts today. Recognize that you matter. You have a sense of value. You should have a sense of a value to God and to his people. Your needs matter, but you need to learn how to express them to other people. And then when you hear of those needs, do what you can to care for them. If you're around people that love you, and you should be, they'll respond in love and grace. Okay? We've kind of taken longer than I had thought, but that's usually the case. Maria talks a lot. Yeah, I know. So I know and we're going to do a song. If you want prayer about any of these things, we would be happy to pray with you. And I guess worship team, you want to come up and kind of close our time up, and then we'll be here for prayer. And Wendy, however you feel like you want to lead us in some ministry time.